This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Oh, folks, listen, wherever you're listening, anywhere in the United States, the island of Guam, Santorini, Greece, whatever it is that you call home right now, I can guarantee you that this hour is going to have some meaning for you, and at the end of it, you're going to be such a smart aleck. You're going to go around to the rest of the family saying, wait a minute, did you know that when it came to the Protestant Reformation, this is what really happened? Yeah, because that's what we're talking about. I wanted to do this show now for a long, long time. And since this program, The God Show, has been on for 20 years, anything short of that is a long, long time. I've also waited to talk to these gentlemen, academic representatives of ASU's School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies. Who else would we get on the 500th anniversary of the Reformation than Dr. Andrew Barnes, representing not only that department, but his specialty of African and European history, joined by Dr. Blake Hartung, whose specialty is ancient Christianity. Oh, yes, I'm obligated to say whose specialties for both of them happen to be everybody who ever played for the St. Louis Cardinals. Now, we got that out of the way, guys?
Yeah.
All right, now listen, if you will, and just since we're talking from three different locations, pick up wherever it is that our other guest left off. When I ask you to begin with, Dr. Barnes, to tell us about the Holy Roman Empire pre-Reformation. What was the planet like then?
Well, the Holy Roman Empire at the point was, it was a working, I think it was a working corporation is probably the best way to frame it. I mean, there were various independent parts of it. When you think of it, you need to think of Central Europe, and you need to think of Italy. And especially since there was a connection between the Habsburgs, who ruled the Holy Roman Empire, and the Habsburgs, who ruled the Spanish Empire, then basically at that point in time, especially under Charles V, of the Holy Roman Empire, and who was simultaneously Charles I of Spain, it's pretty much most of continental Central and Western Europe, except for basically France, and then, of course, England on the side.
But that we're talking about a lot of power coming from the Church, the Pope, the Vatican.
Yes. I mean, the best way to approach that is to keep in mind that most of the government officials who ran that empire for the Holy Roman Emperor were in fact churchmen, and who had primarily degrees in theology, and then secondarily degrees in law, but that law was primarily canon law or church law. So. Very much an enormous amount of concentration of power in a specialized elite, if you will.
And Dr. Hartung, who I will refer familiarly through the program as Blake, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Blake, with that power and the association with the government heads in that huge part of the planet, also went some valuable economic power, too, didn't it?
Yeah, certainly. Although, you know, the Holy Roman Empire was an incredibly decentralized organization. And I think it's kind of, the name of it is kind of deceptive, because when you think of an empire, you think of something that is very cohesive and unified. And that was really not the case for the Holy Roman Empire. And it really wasn't the case for the church either. I mean, the church was far more decentralized than the Catholic Church is today.
In what way was it decentralized, Blake?
Well, the Pope was less able to exercise direct authority over individual dioceses than popes are today. So today, popes like name, you know, every bishop that is, you know, in the entire global Catholic Church. That wasn't the case and it was also the case that, you know, kings and rulers and princes played a role in sort of elevating people to church positions. And, you know, like Andrew said, a lot of the people who were powerful people within the Holy Roman Empire, like Archbishop Albrecht of Mainz, who kind of helped set off the whole controversy with Martin Luther because he wanted a third bishopric for himself. He was trying to, you know, it was the name of the game was buy your church office by paying enough money to the right person.
How spiritual of them. Blake Hartung, Dr. Blake Hartung, from ASU School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies, profile Martin Luther for us right now, would you please?
Martin Luther is one of these people from history who just really stands out as a person. I mean, you know, a lot of historians don't buy to that kind of great man theory of history anymore, you know, that there are just sort of certain indispensable people, you know, who sort of change history around them. But Martin Luther was a very unique person, and he had a kind of unique upbringing and a unique kind of psychology that sort of made him, you know, I think a fit for the moment. He grew up in a small town, kind of from a very just emerging into middle class family. His father was a miner. Grew up in a small town. He's the first to go to a university. He went to study law. And while he was there studying law, he has a kind of a fears for his life during a thunderstorm and makes a vow to Saint Anne that he will become a monk. And much to his father's dismay, he goes and fulfills that vow, becomes a monk in Augustinian monastery, eventually gets a doctorate degree and becomes a professor of theology at the new University of Wittenberg. But he's, as a person, just a sort of bombastic, foul-mouthed, beer-drinking, it really enjoyed scatological humor, really left his enemies absolutely no room for middle ground. He was a fire and brimstone kind of guy in a lot of ways.
Well, it sounds like some of the students that went to school with me at the Catholic schools that I attended. Dr. Barnes, look, we have this profile, and please feel free to add to what Blake just said. But when was the falling out? It seems as if historically he was pretty faithful to the church up to some point. When did he decide to go to the door and tack those things up?
Well, there are two things that I would sort of add to what Blake was saying. One is would be that, and this is how I teach Luther, the term athlete, which we associate with physical achievement, its first real use in European civilization was this, was in the context of spiritual athleticism, of people who gained some recognition or renown for their spiritual achievements. And Luther was very much a person of that sort of ilk. I mean, if you think of it, and getting that sort of foul mouth, I mean, he was a jock in a certain way. And a lot of the stuff that we need to think about Luther is we need to think about him as having sort of a same personality that we associate with jocks, et cetera, especially the older he got. He became a very serious good old boy. But when he was younger, he was simply a very gifted spiritual athlete. And that was part of his reputation. He was a gifted spiritual athlete who was also very, very smart. It needs to be stressed. In a lot of cases, he was the sharpest pencil in the pack there. And he had some recognition that way, which is why he got a university position at teaching theology, and why he was actually, as a young Augustinian, he was sort of going up the ranks. And people clearly at that time thought, okay, this guy at some point is going to be maybe, it's going to be high up in the Augustinian order in Germany. And the point there is that he was an athlete, but he always had that capacity, and people looked at him as a future coach, as one of those guys like a shortstop or a second baseman. You know, they just know the game so well, you figure that one of these days they're going to manage it. And so Luther had that reputation. It was from that persona that, as, okay, I'm a smart guy, in particular the fact that he was a star professor at the University of Wittenberg, and there was a particular issue about whether or not Duke Frederick, who owned that university, also had a huge collection of relics that he basically invited people to sort of come to visit, almost as a tourist type of thing. And it's in that sense that when the question came up of preaching a new indulgence, and a new indulgence would certainly cut into the sort of revenue that Duke Frederick would be making, that his star professor sort of, you know, joined the list to sort of make the case against the idea that the sort of treasury of grace that the Dominicans were going to offer based upon that new indulgence what was worth more than sort of coming to Wittenberg and sort of seeing the relics of Duke Frederick. So it's in that sense that, no, we can sort of trace the spiritual struggle, but, you know, when he entered into these lists here, he didn't think of it from the point of view that, okay, I'm going to sort of challenge the authority of the church. I'm going to challenge the authority of the rival religious order that's basically preaching in my territory, and I want to make clear that I don't think that the basis of which they're sort of preaching is absolutely valid.
All right, but as Andrew Barnes, Dr. Barnes from Arizona State University, has just told us, this is a guy, that is Martin Luther, was being groomed to be, if you'll allow me to continue the sports analogies, the MVP. And yet, did he not become what we categorize today as a whistleblower? I'm asking you, Blake.
Technically all Martin Luther did on October 31st in 1517, when he sort of, in this sort of iconic image, right, of going and nailing the 95 Theses to the door, all he was technically doing was saying, inviting debate. These are 95 points of debate that he would like to have. Now, pretty quickly, this goes beyond an academic debate. People make copies, make printed copies of the 95 Theses, circulate them around, they translate them into German. This starts getting big really fast. And so I guess if you're looking at this, you know, kind of from the perspective of Luther and his reputation, which certainly he didn't, you know, want people to see it that way. But if you want to look at it from that perspective, his reputation was growing as this issue continued to, you know, kind of grow and expand. But I don't think that was what he was purely going for. I mean, he clearly had a kind of clear conviction that comes through in the 95 Theses that the sale of indulgences is a kind of cheapening of God's grace. And not only that, but it also robs these poor Christian peasants in Germany, who Luther was always sort of keen to kind of put himself alongside, at least until his condemnation of the peasant revolt. He kind of robs them of their livelihood by, you know, forcing them to pay for something that, you know, Luther sort of famously says in one of the 95 Theses, if the Pope has the ability to, relieve souls in purgatory, then why does he not do so out of the goodness of his heart?
Well, I promise you that the best of my ability, at least, to keep this promise, this is intended to be the last sports metaphor. But it turned out to be after those were either hung outside the door or tacked to the door. However it is that he made that public statement, it became Luther versus the Vatican. And Luther lost. At least he was excommunicated, which virtually everybody that I know, along with me as a member of the Catholic Church, would consider that to be a major loss. Was he surprised at the extent to which the church took this, Andrew?
Well, I think so. But it's worth stressing that he was a very devout man. And it's in the sense that what happened at the Diet of Worms, in a diet was basically a legislative assembly where the emperor goes and listens to petitions from his people. And one of the petitions he listens to is the petition of Duke Frederick that Duke Frederick's star professor not be sort of condemned by Rome. But when he gets there, he's confronted with, okay, all you've got to do here is to recant. All you've got to do is to say, your writings and your teachings in the past have been wrong. But it's historically important that he couldn't do that. That he basically said, no, I have a conscience, and significantly, religion has to come down to conscience and what you believe on the inside, even at the cost of your life. And that's an old Christian idea. So he felt himself to be very much in the true Christian tradition of saying, I can't do that. I can't recant. And for him to get to that point really did reflect the extent to which I certainly think he felt like he had been pushed to the brink, and that in making that statement, he was committing himself if the example of Jan Hus from a century before was at any value, he was basically agreeing to, he was committing suicide. And Duke Frederick made sure that did not happen, so that when Luther left the Diet of Worms and left the sort of specific protection of the emperor, Duke Frederick kidnapped him and hid him away in a monastery. But I mention that in part because there's this great painting of him when he's masquerading as this guy, and you can just see this. He's very, very different from the older Luther, that sort of, you know, jovial guy or the jolly guy that people think of. You just see this young, gaunt man who clearly has been engaged in a ton of spiritual struggle. And that's how I would characterize Luther in those sort of early years.
Well, even the modern Catholic Church will acknowledge the fact that Martin Luther was driven to that decision because of corruption in the church on the highest levels. We're speaking with Dr. Andrew Barnes, Dr. Blake Hartung of ASU's School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies on this, the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. So I will place this in your lap, Blake. How corrupt was the church at that time?
Well, I mean, the church had dealt with corruption throughout the Middle Ages. I think, you know, once you get almost a vast majority Christian society in which the church has both political and spiritual power, you're bound to have corruption, and that corruption manifested itself in the form of the buying and selling of church offices, the sort of use of things like indulgences to, build extravagant, palaces and structures that, could arguably be taken as kind of fleecing the common people. Marriage and, maybe not marriage, but the priests taking essentially mistresses. This was very common. These kinds of things had been happening in the church for centuries, and Luther wasn't the first person to ever speak out against corruption in the church. There had been this kind of constant tug of war throughout the Middle Ages between church corruption at high levels and people who spoke out against that corruption. Like Andrew mentioned, Jan Hus, a century before Luther, who was burned at the stake by the Council of Constance as a heretic. John Wycliffe in England before, and then people who were officially part of, you know, are officially recognized by the Catholic Church as, you know, as saints and reformers like St. Francis and St. Dominic.
But Blake, wasn't even the vow of celibacy also an economic decision at that time by the Church?
Yeah, when the celibacy was instituted as kind of official policy in I think it was the 11th century. I think that's right. When that happened, it was essentially there was a sense that priests were using their position to favor their family members with church money, church offices, church property. And the reformist faction within the Catholic Church at that time thought it would be the best decision to just make priestly celibacy the general policy to keep, to basically as a guard against corruption.
Gee, the Church these days seems as if they've cleaned up an awful lot of scandalous messes. No matter what. Some of the headlines are, it just seems that at that period of time, people like Martin Luther, the monk, the clergyman, had a lot of reasons to feel as if his organization was not what he originally thought it was. Andrew Barnes, what do you think? And I'm just asking you, of course, obviously, to speculate. And Dr. Crow, the president of Arizona State University, will not in any way dock your paycheck if he's offended by your answer.
As long as you can assure me of that.
Andrew, okay. What would Martin Luther's reaction be to the result of his spiritual revolution today, with hundreds, some say even thousands, of Protestant denominations as a result of his basic statement about the Church?
It's worth stressing that Luther was as articulate, not as articulate a proponent of a state church as anybody who ever came down the pike, but that he really felt through the idea of a state church probably more than any other person. I mean, it's worth stressing that again. I'll go back. I can't use sports metaphors, but he part of his power, part of his success was his capacity to operate as a consultant for various sort of states, for various kings and princes who said, I like your ideas about how the church should operate. Can you come to my territories and help me put together a church, help me reform my church into a workable operation? And Luther was really gifted at that. And you can think back to his catechism as one great example of that. This is a move that we take it for granted today, but really was like an innovation at that time. But the thing about it is that Luther, I think, would shudder, because for him, religion was a top-down thing, and moving past the power of the authority claimed by the Pope, according to Luther, the ultimate source of the corruption is that the Pope and the priesthood are usurping the authority that God had given to the prince, the ruler, and so that's the basis of his famous appeal to the German nobility. It's up to you to come in and reform the church, and God needs you to sort of make all these decisions. It's not that these churchmen are inherently evil. It's just that they're claiming a power and authority that they don't they should not rightly claim, and that to the extent to which you as a state can step in and offer offer direction here, then everything will be better. So for Luther, looking at all of the proliferation of churches today, I think that would give him a great deal of comfort.
On this, the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, we're looking at that time in world history and what it means this time in world history, and we're doing so with two highly respected academics, Dr. Andrew Barnes and Dr. Blake Hartung. And you're listening to The God Show, by the way, I should remind you, on Spotify or iTunes or on the Star Worldwide Networks. com. And by the way, I should remind everybody that if you happen to be dialing around, taking a look at where the Star Worldwide Networks might be, remember it's plural, starworldwidenetworks.com. The God Show, looking at the Reformation, and I ask Dr. Hartung, Blake Hartung, from Arizona State University, that with the dramatic changes that we've been talking about, brought about by Martin Luther and the early decisions that were made as a result of the Reformation, how has the Catholic Church remained so influential to this day?
Well, the Catholic Church eventually responded to Martin Luther in an organized fashion. It took a few decades, but it eventually happened, and the result of that was a council, the Council of Trent, and a kind of, for the first time, a sort of clear statement of what it really meant to be a Catholic, and which, you know, being a Catholic was just kind of a given in Western Europe, unless you were a Jew, and so. To kind of actively define what made a person Catholic and what was required to remain in fellowship with the Pope and that kind of thing was an important step. And groups like the Jesuits were founded in an attempt to kind of help to solidify Catholic unity in the face of the Reformation. So there was an active, what's called the Catholic Reformation or the Counter-Reformation. I prefer the Catholic Reformation because it wasn't entirely just countering the Protestants. And, you know, the Council of Trent ended the sale of indulgences. So the actual, like, you know, thing that Luther was protesting against originally was something that was addressed and ended. And, you know, the Council of Trent didn't make all of the changes that Luther and the Protestants wanted, certainly not. But in some ways, if Luther, I think, saw the Catholic Church today, he would be pretty satisfied in some respects. I mean, today, Catholics take communion regularly, and they take it in both kinds, both bread and wine, whereas at the time, the lay people were typically only given the bread, and it was rarely taken. Today, Catholics read the Bible in their vernacular language, and actually the Church encourages personal Bible study, right? I mean, the popes talk about this today. Catholics celebrate worship not in Latin, but in the vernacular language, typically. And that's something that Luther actively wanted to see. And so I think, you know, there are certain things that are just very clear that Luther, and, you know, this is all speculation, but I think Luther, they certainly accord with the program of reform that Luther wanted to see for the Church.
Blake, you mentioned just a moment ago that at that time, the time of the Reformation, essentially, at least in greater Europe, you were either a Catholic or a Jew. Is it not true that Martin Luther at least has the reputation historically for being anti-Semitic?
Oh, he has that reputation, and it is rightly earned, because his writings against the Jews, the one treatise, The Jews and Their Lies, I think is the name of it, is a horrific kind of very much drinking deeply from the well of medieval anti-Semitism, which was deep and had, you know, a variety of kinds of tropes and sort of, you know, basically kind of baseless rumors and insinuations about Jews. And Luther bought into that stuff, especially, and I think Andrew mentioned this earlier, later in his life. Luther, in the 15th kind of last decade of his life, Luther gets really you know, not entirely sure what's going on in his psychology, and we can't speculate on that. But he gets really mean in a lot of ways in a lot of his writings, and that definitely comes across in his writings against Jews.
Does that surprise you? I mean, considering the fact that you both consider Martin Luther to be an intellectual, and the movement created an intellectual aura around later Roman Catholicism with the Jesuits and so on. Does it surprise you, Blake, that he was as active in his anti-Semitism as he was?
No, again, because he was very much a kind of medieval, you know, kind of the medieval man, and, you know, medieval Christianity. I think Christians are only starting to reckon with this. Medieval Christianity was, in a lot of ways, deeply anti-Semitic, in the ways, you know, in the kinds of rumors and insinuations and riots and pogroms that would happen from time to time against Jewish communities. So I'm not surprised, no.
Dr. Barnes, I'm going to ask you the same thing. As a person whose specialty has been African and European history, dealing also with religion, philosophy, and people of color in such a vast part of the world, your response to that kind of bias on the part of a spiritual leader like Martin Luther?
Well, it's worth stressing that Luther, especially in those last years, had become frustrated with the idea that, okay, I've made it easy for everybody to be a Christian. The idea that that Jews weren't converting because they were opposed to the ideas of the Roman Church. Well, according to Luther, I had gotten rid of those, so they should be ready to convert. Which obviously, no, they weren't interested in doing that. But but you can take this even further. I mean, Blake brought up earlier. I mean, the peasant war of 1525, and here it's the people that are nominally Luther's people, the people he identifies with, the peasants, and yet he's telling the rulers, you got to slaughter these people, you got to wipe them off the face of the earth because they dare to sort of mess with the progress of religious reform by introducing their own sort of personal economic grievances, et cetera. And he was, in that sense, a person who was, you know, you can say profoundly conservative, and that he believed that every type of initiative should come from the top, and that the task of people below is to respond positively to the good things that come from above, to suffer through the things that are bad, but respond positively to the good. But also, he was somebody who was, and in later years, very frustrated with the fact that his ideas of reform didn't have a wider report. Already by those times, obviously, there was a second generation of Protestant reformers, and people were already taking the ideas that he saw as being his and taking him in directions he didn't approve. So in those last years, I think he was struggling a lot with a sense of, okay, people are messing up what I tried to do. People are sort of are destroying the good that I've tried to create, and among them were Jews, but that set of people was much broader than just Jews. I think that's important to understand.
Andrew, I just decided I'm going to depart for just a moment because I don't get a chance to talk to you that often about things like religion and the spread of spiritual thinking, philosophies involving religious leaders of the past and present. And I'm going to ask you this question because it's always bugged me. And that is, whether it's a Catholic missionary or any one of the groups of Catholic missionaries or any one of the hundreds of Protestant missionaries, that all seem over the decades and decades and centuries to wind up going to Africa, telling native Africans that their religions have been wrong all this time, and you're really only going to have a life now and later if you convert to my religion. Do the missionaries really have that much of an influence on a typical African citizen learning about Christianity perhaps for the first time? Or are they just thought of as busybodies?
That's difficult to say. I think a better way of framing it would be to say that, as you just identified, there are a whole wide spread of missionaries having very different ideas, and typically because missionaries sort of followed the traders, the European traders, and they followed the commercial routes, et cetera. It was typically the case that in most places there would be multiple missionaries. The people, Africans who wanted to embrace Christianity, who were attracted to Christianity, always had a spectrum of people who listened to it. I did a bunch of interviews way back when of a really fine old sort of Irish Catholic missionary, and by the name of Father McGuire. And Father McGuire used to joke about, well, the thing that we Catholics had that really sort of got us got us an edge against the Protestants, that we let people drink, whereas the Protestants would let people drink.
God bless Father McGuire.
God bless Father McGuire. But his point, his broader point he was making was that, okay, as a missionary, this guy has been in Africa for 45 years, which is part of what I really admire. And he says part of what you have to accept, that people are going to listen and hear what they want to hear and what you say. And so in a lot of instances, you can say that a lot of that stuff got filtered out. Right? I think that for the people who were attracted to Christianity, the good news outweighed the bad news.
I have no doubt, Andrew. There's no reason for me to question the sincerity of missionaries, particularly when I look at young Mormons, 18, 19, 20 years old, sometimes in the middle of their education or a very successful athletic career. And all of a sudden, they're gone to some unheard of place on the planet. I have no doubt that most of those missionaries are very sincere, but I just keep thinking of it as the recruiter from the college who goes looking for the seven-footer because their college is better than the other college that was there last week.
Again, the thing that I would stress, I mean, and this is something I actually work on a great deal, I mean, there was never a time, even with the earliest missionaries, where what the missionaries were saying was the only thing that Africans heard. I that part has to be stressed. My caution there really is that I'm conscious of the extent to which many missionaries were basically saying, let me just put it simply, what missionaries wrote themselves to have said and what missionaries claimed to have done when they get back to the descending world as opposed to the receiving world, it needs to be always sort of modified by the reality of the fact that missionaries overwhelmingly talk to translators. And it came down to the African translating that message, to use the old Mamasene idea, translating that message in terms of what Africans heard and Africans received. And the sort of differential, the cognitive dissonance between those things became obvious really when people sat down and started to translate the Bible, when they would spend days, weeks, sometimes months translating different passages that missionaries out there preaching preaching in the village, and he's got one translator, or sometimes there will be one guy translating from one language to it, and another guy translating from that language to another language. I don't know how much of that stuff got through. It comes up later in the question of missionaries always complaining about people backsliding, saying, well, you know, people say that they're Christians, but they're not doing all these Christian things, and which people say, that's not what we heard you guys to say Christianity is about.
Blake, do you have a comment?
If you'd permit me, Pat, I think we could actually kind of connect this to Luther a little bit.
Please.
Luther was not missionary proselytizing was not on his radar at all. He was very much kind of focused on what was going on in Europe. But he was very interested in sort of the application of the Reformation ideas to common people. And he was constantly frustrated by the fact that common people seemed to have missed a lot of the things that he was saying and kind of picked up on things that maybe he didn't mean or, you know, implications that he didn't want. So Andrew mentioned the Peasants' Revolt, which Luther, you know, fiercely condemned. But the Peasants' Revolt was very much kind of inspired by the ideals of the Reformation, but it was a translation of Luther's theology that he thought was totally inappropriate. And so he was willing to, you know, say to the princes of Germany, like, yeah, crush these people, kill them, because this is like a kind of political radicalism that doesn't have any place in my kind of vision of the Reformation.
Blake, let's talk for just a moment before we run out of time. The Reformation's impact on the beginnings of America. I find that interesting.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you can't, America was founded by Protestants, you know, almost exclusively. I think there were a couple of Catholics in the original Continental Congress, but, you know, almost exclusively Protestants. And so, you know, that's certainly worth noting. And I think that you have to understand the kind of ideals of the Reformation had a real impact on the development of the kind of the intellectual life of Europe. You know, the idea of kind of taking a stand for one's own conscience, the idea of the priesthood of all believers as a kind of equalizing principle that, you know, in a way, there's a pastor who is the leader, but they spiritually are no different from me. There's a kind of principle of equality that's there that I think maybe gets picked up by some of the political thought that had a profound influence on the founders of the United States. So, you know, there are certain respects in which, yeah, the Reformation certainly has an impact.
We have Dr. Andrew Barnes on the God Show, Dr. Blake Hartung, both from Arizona State University's School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies. And we're looking at the Reformation, not only because it's fascinating and the impact that Martin Luther individually, and of course other people during the time who were influential, had on society then and society now is remarkable. And we're doing this as we reflect on the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. Andrew, every once in a while I allow myself the indulgence of a pretend time machine. And when we're talking historically like this, I love going back to say, well, wait, what if someone had convinced Luther to change his mind about being as public as he was, about so many of his concerns and so many of his criticisms of the church? What if he attempted to make changes, the corruption of the church, privately, quietly, and there had not been the Reformation that we think of as coming from singularly Martin Luther, what would have happened?
Well, I got two quick comments there. First is that Luther would have said, I'll be quiet if all these Dominicans who are clamoring for my head will be quiet. I think he felt himself, you know, very much under the gun of being attacked by a rival religious order, and so he was determined to defend himself. And so he would have said, look, I would be happy to go through this fight. He was a top-down kind of guy. And to the extent to which the people at the top took the initiative, he was always going to support that. Second part, though, and this goes back to what Blake was talking about earlier, very much of what Luther embraced as the type of reform he wanted. You know, the Counter-Reformation Catholic Church, Reformed Catholic Church that evolved over the 16th century, embraced a lot of those ideas, and so from that point of view, a lot of what Luther had to say it was something that, in fact, was embraced by later generations.
Well, Luther, at the beginning of Protestantism, wasn't the only protester, was he, Andrew?
No. And it again, if you, you know, we haven't brought up the idea of was it Andreas Karlstadt, who was the guy who, when Luther was in hiding, decided to come out and take the sort of lead in the Reformation and terrified Duke Frederick and the rest of these people of with his radical ideas. I mean, a lot of the ideas that the peasants then embraced really came from him as opposed to Luther. But the point is that there were always those who said Luther is not going far enough. Who said that, you know, there are people on one side like Erasmus who was saying you're going too far. But on the other side, there were people who were saying he's not going far enough in making this case. So Luther, in his own mind, was going, you know, was embracing the idea that what I'm doing is what the ruler wants. I'm helping the rulers sort of realize the idea of a true Christian church, a true Christian community church. And in that sense, it wasn't a church that was committed to sort of the idea that what we embrace as Protestants today, certainly I would agree with Blake, it goes back to Luther's idea of conscience. And certainly America was founded based on that idea of individual conscience. But Luther always said, you know, the individual Christian's got to spend all of his time fighting with Satan, because Satan's primary objective is to tell you things that are really stupid and have you follow them. So Luther, in effect, say it's up to the state, and the individual's idea has to sort of yield to the state. And for him, that was not that far from what eventually became the idea of the Counter-Reformation Church or the Catholic Reformation.
But Blake, do I hear both of you saying that if there had not been a Martin Luther at that time, there would still have been a Reformation?
I think so. There would have been somebody else. I mean, there already was somebody else. There was, you know, Zwingli, Ulrich Zwingli in Switzerland was basically independently reforming around the same time as Luther. And Andrew already mentioned Karlstadt. So, I mean, this stuff was happening, and it was going to happen, and I think it was sort of, you know, I don't like to speak in terms of inevitability, but you know, the printing press is becoming more and more common. Literacy is becoming more common. Europe is becoming more urbanized. There's a kind of growing anti-clerical backlash against the church. I think that a lot of these issues were sort of burned. You know, they were about to boil over, and it didn't matter. And Luther was sort of the perfect figure, you know, had that kind of charisma and this self-confidence in his view of things, who was able to really take that and really run with it. But I imagine it could have unfolded in similar kinds of ways otherwise.
And Andrew, with all of the influence that the church had with world leaders across Europe, it seems that the one we hear about more than anyone is Henry VIII and his involvement with Luther, with a whole lot of wives, and with the Reformation. Could you pursue that? We have about 4 minutes left.
Well, again, Henry's case. I mean, the ultimate outcome of Henry's ideas was he agreed with the idea of a top-down church. He agreed with the idea that reform has to come from above, not below. He took issue with the idea of this particular monk having any overarching say, and in that sense, he defended the papacy against Martin Luther's attacks. But today, probably more daylight between what Luther was saying and what Henry was saying than maybe people. I know people at the time. I mean, all of those early sort of English reformers really did say Martin Luther's ideas are great, that people can convince the king to sort of follow him, and it's only when they end up being martyred do they realize that Henry's not interested in this. But then, like Tyndale and the Bible, when they get a second chance later in the context of Henry actively seeking to sort of reform the English church, they grab it and they create the Church of England based upon some very similar ideas.
I'm going to ask you this one final question. Immediately identifying myself again as not only an Irish Catholic, but also somebody who never went to anything but a Catholic school. And so I will tell you that it was not uncommon for Catholic educators to somewhere along the line, as we studied the Reformation, to say some form of this, and that is that while Martin Luther was predominantly responsible for the existence of the beginnings of Protestantism and as it's grown, Martin Luther still died a Catholic. And I heard it so many times from so many educators. I'd like to hear from you, Dr. Blake Hartung, first.
Well, he was excommunicated, so I don't know how you can say that. I mean, he certainly considered himself a Catholic, a Christian. He just rejected the authority of the Pope over the Church. So if that's your criteria, if that's one of your key criteria for being a Catholic, he certainly doesn't meet it.
No, and excommunication doesn't often completely dampen the Catholic fervor that people have individually in their feelings about the Church.
Not.
Andrew,
certainly
your
not.
Thoughts on that contention?
I'm actually quite comfortable with that formulation. I don't think he was, Luther... Luther was about the individual Christian struggle with belief, and his solution there, I think, was a solution that, if you look at it in the context of the sort of modern devotion, the devotional moderna of the late 15th century, it's not that far off from, again, somebody I mentioned earlier, Erasmus, right? Where Luther really did differ was in the insistence that churchmen cannot run a church. A churchman cannot, that's up to the state, because the church is more than just the church. It's a community as well. And the state has that the state was given a mandate by God to maintain the church, to lead the church, and to guide the church. A churchman as part of the state, Luther really advocated that, and let's face it, if you look at the France and Spain after that, they pretty much follow the same model, and those states remain Catholic. So I don't know if his idea of Christianity really did differ. I look at Zwingli, I look at Karl Stott, I look at Calvin, I look at those as the people who really did sort of forge what I think is what most about the Protestant mind.
Well, I certainly hope that our listeners, wherever they are in the world, appreciate the fact that the God Show has given them, all of you, an opportunity to audit these extraordinary classes presented by Dr. Andrew Barnes, Dr. Blake Hartung, both from the faculty of Arizona State University. Mine is a much smaller school. It's just a studio with a microphone and a very faithful audience. On the Star Worldwide Networks, I'm Pat McMahon on The God Show. God Show. God Show. God Show. God Show.